then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of...
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's April the 21st, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom, 'tis the rising.
I want to start out by warning you folks that I'm in the middle of undergoing my annual bout of upper respiratory infection today, and so that's why I'll probably sound like Lurch from the Addams Family for most of the show. Fortunately, WavePad lets me edit out the massive attacks of convulsive coughing, which will probably interrupt my delivery on this show. But seriously, guys, if I do sound a bit odd on this one, that's why. The Edgar Steele trial starts on Tuesday, April the 26th, so not much point in recapping at this point. No earth-shaking new developments that I'm aware of. Instead, we'll start off with another trip back in time to the thrilling days of yesteryear and introduce another major figure from our movement's past here in America, whom virtually nobody remembers anymore. Father Charles Coughlin was a Roman Catholic priest who served at Royal Oak, Michigan. Along with Dr. Goebbels in Germany, he was one of the first political leaders in the 1930s to use radio to reach a mass audience. He started out doing short sermons, and then he moved more and more into political and economic topics. At his height, Father Coughlin had more than 30 million listeners tuning in to his weekly broadcasts of his program Social Justice. Coughlin was a genuine champion of the poor, and that meant that early on he was a supporter of Franklin D. Roosevelt and his early New Deal proposals. But like a lot of sincere but deluded people at the time, Coughlin very quickly figured out that New Dealism was, in essence, a form of communism light, and he turned against Roosevelt in a big way. Along with Huey Long, Coughlin was the first major populist leader in the United States to take on the power of the banks and big money, and a lot of his radio sermons were on financial and economic matters, which during the Depression were, of course, at the forefront of everybody's concerns. He was the first public figure of any stature who dared to take on the Federal Reserve. Although as a priest he was forbidden to run for office himself, in 1934 Coughlin formed a new political organization called the Nation's Union of Social Justice, and he backed a candidate named William Lemke to run against Roosevelt in 1936, the year it should have been Huey Long taking on FDR if the Jews hadn't killed him. Coughlin wrote a platform calling for monetary reforms, the nationalization of major industries and railroads, and the protection of the rights of working people. He very quickly ran up a membership into the millions, just like we could do here at the Northwest Front if we could just somehow let the millions of white people out there who are looking for leadership know that we're here. Coughlin was also a rare bird for his time in America, in that in his weekly broadcasts he openly attacked and opposed the Jews, and he supported the policies of Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini. He blamed the Depression on an international conspiracy of Jewish bankers, and also claimed that Jewish bankers were behind the Russian Revolution. On November 27, 1938, he said, quote, "There can be no doubt that the Russian Revolution was launched and fomented by distinctively Jewish influence." And of course, the Jews immediately retaliated by calling him a fascist, which I suppose he was, kind of. Eventually, Roosevelt got worried. And in 1939, as part of his preparation for war, the United States government retaliated by trying to silence Coughlin. Now, the first thing they did was to forbid the dissemination of Father Coughlin's newspaper, Social Justice, through the United States Postal System, which, by the way, the federal government still has the legal right to do whenever they feel like it, even today. The government and organized Jewry, in the form of the Anti-Defamation League, also pressured a lot of radio stations into canceling Coughlin's weekly show. But unlike today, this actually produced serious protests in the streets. On one occasion, 2,000 demonstrators marched on the headquarters of CBS in New York City, demanding that they bring Coughlin back. And they carried signs directed at the network's Jewish owners saying, quote-unquote, "Wait until Hitler gets over here." The way the liberals finally silenced Coughlin was simple. Roosevelt eventually brought pressure to bear on the Vatican, and the Pope told Coughlin to shut up. That's kind of odd in view of the fact that the Jews have always accused the Vatican of being anti-Semitic. Father Coughlin was first and foremost a good Catholic, and when the Pope tells a good Catholic to shut up, he shuts up. And so, Father Coughlin just shut up. He left the air, and nobody ever heard a peep out of him again. He went back to being a parish priest in Michigan, and he died there in 1979, completely forgotten. Copies of Father Coughlin's radio broadcasts themselves are almost impossible to find, and what I was able to locate was mostly either too long or of too poor a quality to play on this show. I'm going to play three selections for you here. The first is a March of Time documentary, which tells you something about Father Coughlin, but which doesn't have much from him directly. And the next two are cuts from election speeches that he gave in favor of various candidates around the country in the 1936 election.
As another presidential election approaches, a Roman Catholic priest, for the first time in American history, is seriously involved in national politics.
Some are unpopular, but God hates the hypocrite! And as long as you shall permit, a little handful of mobilized...
Father Charles Edward Coughlin today is far more than just a voluble voice over the radio. At his shrine of the Little Flower near Detroit, converge elements of a mighty political power. A power that grows with every name added to the 12 million already in his letter files. With every handshake that adds another individual to his colossal following, which he has welded into the most potent political lobby this country has ever known. The single voice, National Union for Social Justice. Father Coughlin's anger ignites an idea which he is soon announcing to his little congregation. He will broadcast his sermons by radio. Out from Royal Oak goes a voice that takes the radio public by storm. Soon the priest is preaching to untold millions in the name of shy, simple St. Therese. A few years later, over a cornerstone shipped from the Holy Land, rises a new church, dedicated by Father Coughlin's sympathetic superior, Bishop Gallagher. A pretentious million-dollar church paid for by his radio audience. A shrine to the little flower of Jesus. Father Coughlin becomes a full-fledged national character. His secretarial staff looks like big business. It must be ready to answer a million letters in a single week. Exuberant in his power, he rushes up and down the land, this servant of the church, now a master of politics. Al Smith, the country's leading Catholic layman, is one of the first to stagger under the impact of Father Coughlin's muscular eloquence. Senators, amazed by his influence, uneasily watch the newspapers. President Roosevelt is first loudly praised, then more loudly played by the voluble priest. Publisher William Randolph Hearst, keen student of mob psychology, calls Father Coughlin to his ranch in California to look him over. A shrewd, old-time Detroit advertising man, rotund Louis B. Ward, attaches himself to the priest, becomes a person of some importance in Washington as interpreter and lobbyist for Father Coughlin. In Boston, Preston, revered old Cardinal O'Connell contemptuously refers to the Coughlin speeches as hysterical addresses and demagogic stuff. New York's Cardinal Hayes says nothing, but his expert on canon law announces that Father Coughlin has no business in politics. In Catholic America, editor Wilfred Parsons writes, "The danger is that many Roman Catholics think it is sinful to disagree with Father Coughlin. They think he must be right because he is for the poor and speaks from the pulpit in the robes of the church. But in the Roman Catholic Church, a priest is answerable only to his immediate superior. And Father Coughlin's superior is his staunchest ally, 68-year-old Bishop Gallagher.
Father Coughlin has preached no heresy. I shall not interfere. Until a lawful superior rules otherwise, I stand steadfastly behind this priest."
Only lawful superior to Bishop Gallagher is in the Vatican. Queries there about Father Coughlin bring no response. But from Monsignor Amleto Cicognani, personal representative of the Pope in America, comes the statement, "What the Holy Father teaches, Father Coughlin preaches." But the Roman Catholic Church is a very careful church, and able priests who become too conspicuous are sometimes made bishops in faraway places.
My dear friends, that among other things in the National Union for Social Justice, we are Christian insofar as we believe in Christ's principle of love your neighbor as yourself. And with that principle, I challenge every Jew in this nation to tell me that he does not believe in it. Communizing all the factories and the fields and the forests and the mines under a new kind of God made of flesh and blood and clay and hatred. When men become so prideful that they believe their destiny is to rewrite the eternal law of God, it's time for their fellow citizens to rise up in their wrath and through the agency of ballots and not bullets to relegate them to the pages of the past.
There is written in the Constitution of the United States that Congress has the right to coin, issue, and regulate the value of money. That's good Americanism, and it's good enough for me. Every politician today in the Democratic or Republican ranks who sits upon one of the thrones of the mighty doesn't believe in that part of the Constitution. They don't want to believe in that part of the Constitution. They believe that the Federal Reserve Bank has the right to coin and regulate the value of money. They're not even Americans, these so-called Democrats and Republicans. And so, Mr. Roosevelt, who was very loquacious in 1933, about bribing the money changers out of the temple, is now bent upon another policy. I think bribing the workmen out of decent annual wages. As I come before you today, I wish to leave this thought with you, that in each congressional district here in Illinois, we will endorse a candidate who can rise above his party and puts patriotism first. He may be a Democrat or a Republican or whatnot, but we're through with the sham battle of politicians, and now we're on our own. Therefore, under your congressional district presidents, your battalions. Take up the shield of your defense. Unsheathe the sword of your truth. And carry on in Illinois so that the communists on the one hand cannot scourge us and that the modern capitalists on the other cannot plague us.
Now, this Radio Free Northwest is dated April the 21st, but I'm actually making it on April the 20th. And we all know what day that is, or we should. Now, I normally try and keep these podcasts as non-sectarian as possible, just like I believe the whole Northwest migration movement needs to be non-sectarian, because I know that we have a lot of listeners who come from all the movement's tendencies, everything from militia to Christian identity to Tea Party. But I've never made any secret of the fact that I personally am a National Socialist. And April the 20th is our day, and so on this day I'm going to speak of my own worldview and my own faith in the destiny of our race. I have always known that Hitler was right. Even when I was a child and I had no idea what National Socialism was all about, I seemed to have an instinctive recognition that all was not right in the society I was growing up in, and that anyone whom the authorities of that society feared, hated, and reviled as much as Adolf Hitler had to have something going for him. Now, when I played Army with the other boys back in North Carolina in the 60s, I always wanted to fight on the German side. Nor was this unusual. There were other boys like myself who drew swastikas on the schoolbook covers and rooted for the Germans when we were watching television shows like Combat or The Gallant Men. There was something in the shape of that Teutonic coal scuttle helmet that just thrilled our very souls, and it still does. I'm using that image now in Freedom's Sons. I've often wondered how this could be when we were so young we couldn't possibly have any idea of the issues involved with the war or what National Socialism was all about, and indeed we were constantly subjected to a barrage of anti-NS propaganda in a time when the war was a very recent memory. Have to bear in mind that when I was growing up, World War II was a much closer event to everyday people than Vietnam or even the first Gulf War is today. I think that it was because there's a kind of innate moral faculty in our people that Aryans are born with, something that instinctively recognizes the difference between truth and lies and between right and wrong. It's a pity more of us can't retain that faculty into our adult lives. But once I grew old enough to understand things a bit, my earlier childish admiration and fascination with the Third Reich and the dynamic figure of Adolf Hitler grew as I came to understand that my initial instincts had been correct. Now, for one thing, even as a child, reading my first books on the Second World War, I never bought into the Holocaust myth. Now, I had no idea what the word logistics meant, but the idea that a nation fighting for its very existence would devote immense resources, manpower, and time to a pointless act of mass extermination was palpably ridiculous. I wrote off the Holocaust story as typical war propaganda, and I read on. Now, when I was about 10 years old, I met my first German war veteran. He was a friend of our family. He was a good-looking, talented, middle-aged artist from Greensboro. I will call him Johann, just in case he still lives. You got to bear in mind, back in those days, a German World War II veteran made no bones about the fact that he'd served. But today, almost 70 years on after the end of the war, it's actually more dangerous for a man in his 90s to admit that he served the Third Reich than it would have been for Johann back in the 60s. Anyway, I didn't know it at the time, but Johann had been a Fallschirmjäger, a paratrooper during the war. And at one cocktail party we were having at our house one night, some loudmouthed redneck friend of my father's was holding forth about how he whooped up on old Hitler and won the war single-handedly. You got a lot of that crap back then. He was describing some battle in Italy and said, "Then the goddamn Nazi paratroopers came raining down out in the sky." And Johann was sitting over in a corner and he looked up quiet and he says, "Yeah, I remember. If it jumped on you, you ran away." And that redneck fool was noticeably silent for the rest of the evening. I was fascinated. Here was a man who had actually worn that helmet, that uniform with the eagle and swastika that I'd seen so often on movies and on TV. And as soon as I could, I got Johann off to one side and I asked him, "Did you ever meet Adolf Hitler?" And he kind of smiled and he says, "No, not personally. But I saw him many times. I'm from Nuremberg, where they had the big rallies. And every year the Führer would drive beneath the window of my house in his open car. And once he looked up and he saw me in the window and smiled at me. Later on, I was Hitler Youth, and I heard him speak." And this German guy was silent for a while, and then he said, "When you heard his words, you knew that there was a God. And years later, I heard the words of Adolf Hitler myself, and I knew. I hear them still. Horst Ludwig Wessel was a National Socialist hero during the Kampfzeit, the time of struggle from 1919 until the day of the German Revolution on January the 30th, 1933. He was an SA man, a brown shirt, or a stormtrooper, and he was murdered by the communists in Berlin in 1930. Now, if anyone's interested, I have a short biography of Horst Wessel that I can send you by email. Wessel was the author of the lyrics to the song Die Fahne hoch, which means Raise the Banner. It's usually known as the Horst Wessel Lied, or the Horst Wessel Song, and that became the Nazi Party's anthem, and later on it became part of Germany's dual national anthem from 1933 to 1945, along with Deutschland über alles. Now, the martyrdom of Horst Wessel led directly to the promotion of his song, Die Fahne hoch, as the official song of consecration for the Nazi Party. And from 1933 on, like I said, it became part of the national anthem, and then after 1945, the song was banned, along with all other National Socialist symbols. Now, both the lyrics and the tune remain illegal in Germany to this day. I know it's hard for Americans to imagine a society where you can be locked up in prison for many years for such crimes as singing a song or raising your arm above your shoulder, but in Germany it happens all the time. Well, the Horst Wessel song isn't illegal here. Not yet.
What is National Socialism? National Socialism is a worldview for white people based on the ideas and concepts of the German racial nationalist philosopher and statesman Adolf Hitler. National Socialism was adapted to the political and racial conditions of the United States by the late U.S. Navy Commander George Lincoln Rockwell. Owing to the tragic and unnecessary suffering which took place during the Second World War, and because certain powerful elements in our society to this day maintain an interest in obscuring and concealing the truth, half a century after the war's end, massive misconceptions still exist in America today about what National Socialism was and is. The National Socialist body of belief is founded on three principles. The first principle is natural order. We believe that the universe is governed by natural laws, and that in order for man to be happy and successful, he must first learn what these laws are and then follow them. We believe that man is a part of the natural world and that he is in no way separate from or distinct from it. Because of this, we believe that society should be structured in accordance with the laws of nature and not in opposition to them, as is the case today. The second principle is racial idealism. Racial idealism is based on the love of one's own people. It means placing the interests and the welfare of the racial community to which you belong ahead of your own personal interests and desires. As racial idealists, we have no wish to harm, exploit, or persecute any other racial groups, despite a persistent media propaganda campaign of abuse and deliberate falsification to the contrary. We are only interested in protecting our own people against extinction, a fate all too likely if nothing is done about present conditions in America. We believe that all men are not created equal. Just as every individual has his own strengths and weaknesses, so each race has certain qualities that make it different from other races. We believe that the white or Aryan race has the right to maintain its own biological, cultural, and political independence and integrity, and that we have the right to control our own destiny. We also believe that the white race has the right to defend itself against all physical, economic, and spiritual assaults, no matter where they come from. And the third principle is the upward development of the white race. We want to do more than just defend our race, we want to see it improve. This can be done by encouraging a high birth rate among those sections of the white population which are the healthiest, strongest, and most intelligent. At the same time, our science should work to eliminate hereditary weaknesses and defects among our people. Our goal is that each new generation of white children will be better than the one before it. National Socialism does not advocate or teach any kind of racial hatred. It simply states the reality of nature, that different races have different abilities and different needs. These different abilities, given by nature and the result of hundreds of thousands of years of evolution, cannot be changed by social programs, by political dogma, or by enforcing dictatorial policies of racial integration which effectively undermine and destroy Aryan identity and Western culture.
When we look around us and see the degree to which society's deteriorated, anyone could be forgiven for believing that the situation is beyond recovery, that America is simply too far gone to survive, and there's no hope at all that anything will ever change. Our world is not only controlled by soul-deadening Jewish materialism, but it's full of madness. Drugs, AIDS, rampant sexual perversion, homeless trash on every street corner, rampant race mixing on television. Every turn we see unspeakably brutal crimes committed mostly by non-whites against white victims, but also, on occasion, committed by soulless white people who have given in to the dark side. There's a pervasive corruption and dishonesty in every aspect of our lives. The media, government, you name it. There's economic chaos. There's the whole Obama depression thing, the foreclosures, 20% unemployment, the poverty, the affirmative action, the pointless wars in the Middle East. Now, all these things and more are the byproducts of a century of liberal democracy. It's overwhelming. No wonder the vast majority of white Americans have simply given up, and they're just hunkering down, trying to stay out of it all and survive. But that is what you as a National Socialist must not do. It is your racial duty not only to fight against the Judaic evil that pervades the world, but to do so with faith and hope in your heart that victory will someday be ours. As a National Socialist, you should also be studying world history extensively. And when you look at the past, you'll observe one historical truth above all others. Nothing lasts forever. Always hold on to that thought. Babylon, Carthage, Rome, the Byzantine and Ottoman empires, Tsarist Russia, the British Empire, some of these governments and societies lasted for thousands of years, and all of them thought they would last forever. They were wrong. Zog thinks it'll last forever, and Zog is wrong, too. The struggle in which we are engaged can be categorized in a lot of ways, but one of the best, most accurate descriptions is that we are part of a conflict between two value systems, materialism, which is essentially Jewish in nature, and idealism, which springs from the Aryan racial personality. Materialism places its primary emphasis on things rather than on people. It's a worldview that considers man to be essentially an economic unit of production and consumption, rather than a thinking, spiritual being. And thus we can see that both of the two worldviews that have held Western society in chains during this last century, Marxism and capitalism, they're both variations of Jewish materialism, which is hardly surprising when one considers that Jews created them both as organized philosophies. Judaic Marxism and Judaic capitalism have very much in common, despite their ostensible opposition to one another. Both systems practice centralized state control of every aspect of human thought or activity, although capitalism usually does this in a milder and gentler form. Both Jewish materialistic systems view human labor as a commodity to be bought and sold and regulated like any other industrial resource. Finally, both Marxist and capitalist regimes rigidly forbid any deviation of thought or purpose from their citizens, and they severely punish anybody who attempts to find any way out, politically or religiously, whatever. This is why capitalist society won't let guys like Randy Weaver just go off up into a cabin in the woods and live their own lives. Neither communism nor capitalism nor liberalism nor socialism or whatever can allow anyone to opt out of the system. They can't allow anyone to say, stop the merry-go-round, I want to get off. Now, the Soviet Union went to one extreme, they had gulags. And in this country, Zog murdered the Weaver family and the children of Waco when they tried to opt out and withdraw. The only difference is a matter of style. National Socialist idealism, on the other hand, believes in quality of life as opposed to quantity of people and consumer goods. National Socialism understands that, as the saying goes, man cannot live by bread alone, that he's more than a producing and consuming animal, a piece of financial livestock for the Jews to herd and fatten up and fleece every now and then. Human existence has to have some kind of religious or spiritual aspect if it's to have meaning, and it's essential that a healthy society develop everything that's good in the human character: courage, creativity, a sense of civic duty, self-sacrifice, love of family and of folk, reverence for the past, reverence for the entire mystery of life, and you don't get that in either capitalist or socialist or liberal societies. Now, these aren't material values, and we see every day in America what happens when these moral and ethical attributes are denied and suppressed. White Americans today have lost all sense of direction. Now, what remains of their traditional culture and values are crumbling under the onslaught of degeneracy and materialistic money grubbing and the Six Flags mentality, and white Americans have become spiritually weak and soft as butter. It's time for a moral and ethical system based on racial values and racial idealism to step forward and assume responsibility for cleaning up this mess. But before we can change society, we first have to change ourselves inside through the National Socialist ideal of Adolf Hitler. To be a National Socialist, a Nazi, a white revolutionary in modern-day America is the most difficult task anyone can possibly undertake. No other lifestyle is as vilified and attacked by the powers that be. The government, the media, every cultural and political institution, Hollywood, even our own friends and family members are lined up against us. Almost overwhelming pressure is exerted against us to conform, to go with the flow, to submit to the inevitable. Every day an avalanche of deceit and lies is hurled down on us. We're insulted and spat on by the very people for whom we are risking our lives and freedom to save. And that is probably, I would say, the very hardest part about being a white nationalist these days. The people that we wish to liberate from tyranny and slavery hate us, and they actually willingly join forces to march against us, side by side with the same reptiles who want to enslave them and use them as livestock. A true National Socialist does not enter into the movement in search of some petty personal gain. he enters the battle for the sole purpose of combating the enemies of his folk. The Commander Rockwell said that the purpose of life is to struggle for what you believe in and to enjoy the struggle as much as you can. That is the very essence of the National Socialist existence, to struggle against those who seek to destroy our race and, if we can, have fun doing it. A National Socialist has to adopt an aristocratic conception of life. He has to understand the simple fact that Aryan man achieves his full potential only when he abandons his concern for material comfort and lives the robust life of the outlaw, a life animated by acts of heroism and adventure. He has to completely turn his back on all the degeneracy and the debauchery of the modern Jew-dominated world. A National Socialist must be a man against time. Everything that the Jew stands for, he has to hold in utter contempt. To be a true National Socialist, it's essential to immerse oneself completely in white racial ideology. Just as a serious and dedicated Marxist devotes hours of his time to the study of the work of Marx, Lenin, and Trotsky, a real National Socialist has to be thoroughly familiar with the works of the great writers and theoreticians of our tradition. This is one of the reasons I'm running some of this older stuff on here, and I'm trying to educate you guys as to the fact that we have a past. You need to be familiar with and read the works of Adolf Hitler, but also guys like Alfred Rosenberg, Kodrianu, Houston Stuart Chamberlain, Rockwell, Goebbels, Francis Parker Yaki. A constant and ongoing study of National Socialist theory will reinforce your faith and nourish your mind and spirit with the nutrition of the soul. Isolating ourselves from family members, old friends, and so-called normal society is an extremely difficult task. But it's absolutely necessary. When you put on the swastika armband and you declare yourself to be a National Socialist, you have to be prepared to make the sacrifices that are required. Once you put on that armband or that swastika in public, the Jews will never forgive and never forget. I'm sure David Duke kicks himself every day over that one incident at the Louisiana State University around 1970 or so, I think it was, when he participated in an NSWPP demonstration as a very young man, and he actually wore the little Manny Kale outfit with the brown shirt and the black tie and the swastika armband. That photograph of Duke holding a sign and wearing a swastika shows up to this day. You have to understand that once you put on the swastika, it's there forever. A true National Socialist not only works day and night for the cause of racial revolution in society, but he also has to be prepared to create a revolution within himself. This is what I've been talking about for such a long time here on these podcasts and elsewhere. We have to transform ourselves into new men, political soldiers. And only National Socialists, I think, are truly morally equipped to do that. National Socialist idealism believes in the quality of life as opposed to the quantity of people and consumer goods. National Socialism understands that, as the saying goes, man cannot live by bread alone, and he's more than a producing and consuming animal. Human existence has to have some kind of religious or spiritual aspect if it's to have meaning. Someday, this corrupt and evil world is going to go down with a crash. Remember the Ceausescus in Romania? They thought they were immortal too, and yet look what happened to them less than a quarter of a century ago. Revolutions are possible, people. God knows we've had enough of them in the past 100 years to prove that. Revolutions are made by people who make the conscious decision that they would rather lose everything than live one more day in a world that has become intolerable. Now, if you can become that kind of person, if you will make the party and the Northwest Migration the center of your life's work in the world, then you can become a part of that process. Always remember, it can be done. It can be done if you will do it.
Yeah.
In my novel, The Hill of the Ravens, I reprinted a piece called 10 Principles of National Socialist Thought. Some people seem to think that I wrote this, and I wish I had, but no, it wasn't me. I honestly don't know who wrote this, and if anyone out there can enlighten me, I'd be grateful. Now, this just showed up in my email one day about 10 years ago, with no attribution, but it's one of the best short statements of the National Socialist worldview I've ever come across. Principle number one, be honest. A National Socialist faces a fact whether he likes it or not. Dishonesty is the mark of the enemy. National Socialism, above all, represents living truth in its purest form. Principle number two, believe in God and yourself. The God of destiny subjects only his strongest mortals to enormous tasks that would crush lesser men. God wills only the best to fulfill the highest task of life, to perfect mankind. Give yourself utterly unto destiny, and God will shield you in your fight. God helps only those who help themselves. We will lose only if we lay down our arms due to our weakness and cowardice. There is only one true disgrace, submission to the enemies of our race. Principle number three, be faithful to your race. No one must be allowed to spoil what nature created down through aeons of racial evolution. Your highest purpose in life is to carry on that evolution toward a stronger, better, more beautiful mankind. The purity and strengthening of the Aryan race is the basic requirement of every future higher evolution. Principle number four, fight for your race. Fight for the holy ideals of National Socialism, the heart of your great race. Only in this struggle can you prove your true worth as a man or a woman. Only thus can you fulfill your potential for courage, dedication, and ennobling self-sacrifice. Life's struggle for survival brought man upwards from the ape-like beings of the distant past to the height of Aryan culture and achievement. The party's struggle will produce the revolutionary elite who will lead the National Socialist ideal to victory. Principle number five, you are a superior individual. You will be outnumbered in this struggle, because the best are always a minority. History-making decisions have never been the work of formless masses, but always victories by active and dedicated minorities. You are both the servant and the spokesperson for your race. Make sure you set an example worthy to be followed in your person and your life. Principle number six, love your brothers and sisters. You owe your existence to your racial family. Let your love of them be your overriding passion in life. Do not fear the undermen, the racially inferior, and do not persecute them. You are their superior, but you are not their owner. When the time comes to fight them, do not lose your senses through counterproductive hatred. Detach yourself, clear your mind, and destroy them completely, methodically, clinically, as if in a surgical operation. Nothing is more pointless than wasting time hating mud people. It detracts from the positive love of your own. Principle number seven, improve your brothers and sisters. All Aryan men and women are your brothers and sisters, although not all are equally intelligent or courageous. It's up to you to inform them, to encourage them, and to instill their hearts with courage. Some of your kinsfolk have been misled and made ugly by the Judaic evil which is corrupting our racial soul. You must not hate them on that account, but rather strive to bring them back to their racial family. Principle number eight, reject the decadence. Decadence is anything which detracts either physically or spiritually from the health and the upward development of our Aryan race. You must hold your racial and spiritual purity above your very life, and not associate with anything which is decadent or which gives your life the appearance of decadence. Every aspect of life must be judged in relation to the survival and improvement of your race. Anything hindering these attainments must be ruthlessly rooted out and destroyed. Principle number nine, the best must rule. All great achievements on earth are the product of great leadership, political or scientific or artistic. The racial community can gain strength only by applying the leadership principle and placing in front the men and women who have demonstrated superior ability, dedication, and tenacity in the racial struggle. Democracy is a sickness which leads inevitably to chaos, corruption, and the collapse of society. From democracy steps forth the cruelest of tyrants. Principle number 10. Nothing is impossible. Where there is a will, there's a way. Everything falls before the man of indomitable will. Suffering and sacrifice are necessary. We're hardening ourselves for the most decisive struggle in all of human history. Victory will fall only to the most truthful, the most fanatical, the strongest, the bravest, and the best. Be that. We now come to the question that has to be faced. Why did National Socialism lose the war? I could run down a whole list of military, economic, and political reasons, and indeed, refighting the war is always one of the primary discussion topics wherever National Socialists gather. But I frankly see no point in getting off onto a subject like that about which whole libraries could be and have been written. I tend to boil it down to two reasons. First off, who were our opponents? Not the Jews and their money power alone. That money power was backed up by the muscle of well over half of the white world at the time, including the British Empire at its height and the United States of America at the top of its game. Unless we forget, the majority of the Soviet Red Army was white as well. Yes, we lost, but it took the entire world to beat us. And when all is said and done, we were beaten by white men. Secondly, long ago, when I was working with the great Ernst Zundel on producing some of his books through Liberty Bell Publications, he said something to me that I've never forgotten. He said, "Harold, if the Western world is ever to be saved, it will be saved either by the Americans or the Russians." And I said, "Why is that?" And Ernst told me, "Because you're both pigs. We Germans tried to do it, but we were too nice about it, and so we finished last, like nice guys do." I think Ernst hit the nail on the head there. The classic example is Hitler's refusal to invade England when he had Churchill by the throat in 1940 and 1941. Instead, he sent Rudolf Hess to England to try and negotiate, and Churchill locked Hess up for the rest of his life for his trouble. I think that even then, the Führer himself, as wise as he was, could not grasp the sheer depth of evil and depravity that Aryans are capable of when they succumb to the Jew and say, "Evil, be thou my good." The Jews themselves have a saying to this effect, "From Jewish heads and Gentile hands, good Lord deliver us." Adolf Hitler knew that he was right, and he always thought somewhere in the back of his mind that somehow the rest of his racial brothers could be made to understand. They couldn't, because they were never allowed to hear his words. Instead, Roosevelt banned Father Coughlin's paper from the mails and pressured American radio stations into pulling his show off the air, and Churchill struck aside the proffered hand of peace and buried the man who offered it alive. It is a sad and terrible fact that good does not always triumph over evil, and that's what happened in 1945. And the price that all of humanity has paid for that defeat of all that is heroic and good in the human spirit has been terrible beyond imagining. A price that you and your family and your race are still paying to this day.
Dreams and ideals and the snow.
I said just now that good does not always triumph over evil, and that's true. I wish it wasn't. I wish we all lived in a fairy tale world where the good guy always wins and gets the girl and rides off into the sunset and all is right with the world, but we don't. But that doesn't mean that the good guy should just shrug his shoulders with a sigh, flop down on the couch, pop the top on a cold one, and pick up the television remote. The old saying about how it's not whether you win or lose but how you play the game has a little something to it. Although I have to admit that losing all the time really sucks. Since I'm sure by this time at least some of my listeners have been made sufficiently uncomfortable by all this Nazi stuff, I'm going to read a couple of famous quotations to you from American presidents, the real kind, the old kind, real live dead white males of the kind that give liberal college professors conniption fits. The first is from Teddy Roosevelt. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes up short again and again, because there is no effort without error or shortcoming, but who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself for a worthy cause, who, at best, knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who, at the worst, if he fails, at least he fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who knew neither victory nor defeat. Perhaps the writers on certain pseudo-intellectual blogs of ours might take note of that one. Now, the second quote comes from President Calvin Coolidge. Nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent. The slogan, "Press On," has solved and always will solve the problems of the human race. I've said this before, probably about 100 times, and I'll say it 100 times more until it sinks in. We do what we do, not because we hope for victory or reward, but because it is right. Devoting our lives to the struggle for the survival of our race and civilization isn't about the Jews, the niggers, the liberals, or the faggots, or the federal government. They are our enemies and our obstacles. They are not our purpose or our goal. Now, this life, this struggle, is not about them. It's about us. When we die and we go before whatever account we're called to by whatever divine or mystical power may interest itself in us, that power is not going to want to hear a long, rambling speech about the Jews or the Federal Reserve or the Trilateral Commission or Obama's birth certificate or anything like that. We will be called to account for ourselves, for what we did and did not do and why. And I somehow don't think that supernatural review board, whatever it may consist of, is going to have much time for excuses about how you couldn't move to the Northwest and become part of history by fulfilling your duty because you had negative equity in your house and you couldn't sell it, or because it was too much trouble and you just couldn't be bothered. The time is coming when our window of opportunity will open. We may miss it out of sheer laziness or incompetence. We may try for it and fail. In the final analysis, that doesn't matter. We're all going to end up in the same place no matter what. The Americans have a saying, life is a game and whoever ends with the most toys wins. When your life ends and you do face whatever you believe lies on the other side, I can tell you one thing for sure. You're not going to be able to take your toys with you. In Shakespeare's play, Hamlet says of his murdered father, "He was a man. Take him for all and all, I shall not look upon his like again." That's what all of you should want carved on your headstones, not, "He played it safe, paid his bills, and died with a lot of toys." Lay your toys aside, people, you don't need them. Lay your fear aside, it's useless and it can't stop you from ending up in that 6-foot hole in the ground. Getting back to Shakespeare, Julius Caesar says, "Of all the wonders I have seen or heard, it seems to me most strange that men should fear, seeing that death, a necessary end, will come when 'twill come. It's not how you die, but how you live that you'll want to be remembered by. Spending your life trying to avoid pain and trouble and suffering is always pretty pointless, but especially so in times like these. Now you can stay where you are and suffer the fate of a white man or woman in Obama's America, and that's shaping up to be a pretty nasty fate. Or you can come here to our people's homeland and suffer the fate of a man and maybe a hero. Your choice, guys. I'm here, and I'm ready when you are." Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.